The following is a CNA podcast.
If we don't get serious about climate change today, it will be too late for our children to do so tomorrow.
It's time to say enough. Enough of brutalizing biodiversity. Enough of killing ourselves with carbon. Enough of treating nature like a toilet. Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves.
It's simple. Will we act? Will we do what is necessary? Will we seize the enormous opportunity before us? Or will we condemn future generations to suffer?
You just heard from Boris Johnson, Antonio Guterres, and Joe Biden. Their voices are some of the most prominent of the more than 120 world leaders here in Glasgow, attending global climate change talks. My name is Jack Board, CNA's climate change correspondent, and this is a special edition of Climate Conversations, brought to you from COP26 in Glasgow. Within this venue, in the plenary halls, on stages, in corridors, and behind closed doors, the future of our planet is being decided. While standing in a queue for a milky overpriced coffee, it seems like a strange thing to think about. The situation has never been more urgent. The world's scientists have told us so. So it's clear that there is much at stake. But some people whose lives are directly affected don't have a seat at the table. We typically label them as from the developing world, the global south. And that includes much of Southeast Asia, where the damaging impacts of climate change are already being felt. I wanted to speak to those who have managed to be here, understand their stories, and see if they believe that their voices are being heard. When you add up the issues of actually getting to the UK, the uneven rollout of vaccines for COVID-19, visa issues, and the high costs, many people feel frozen out from the negotiating process. Getting from the Philippines to Glasgow then was a task that required more patience and resiliency than usual. They're attributes well suited to this mother and daughter duo, Vicky and Jing Tauli-Corpus. They're now relative veterans of the international negotiating circle. Both of them are from the Cordillera region in Luzon, and for years, they have been leading voices in the fight for climate change justice and rights for Indigenous peoples and local communities, not just in their home region, but all around the world. The plight of Indigenous groups has been included as a discussion point during COP26, but it still largely remains a peripheral topic. And that's despite Indigenous people protecting about 80% of the biodiversity remaining across the globe.
I am Vicky Tauli-Corpus. I am a Kankanae Igorot, an Indigenous person from the Philippines, from the Cordillera region. And I'm here as the Executive Director of Tubtuba, which is my institution. I used to be the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
I'm Jing Tauli-Corpus. I'm Vicky's daughter. I also have different hats. I work for an organization called Nia Tero. It's a US-based foundation that supports Indigenous guardianship. They wanted to talk about the physical journey coming here. We almost didn't make it. Because when we applied for our visa, the Philippines was still in the red list. And you can't travel if you're in the red list unless it's for a compelling reason. And then midway through the visa application process, we were transferred to the green list. But our application was put in the non-COP26 list. So I had to camp out in Manila, follow up every day. So that to make sure that we had our visa, and then we got it 6 hours before our flight.
Can you tell me a bit about your people, your home, and the climate change experience that has affected that community?
We come from the mountains. Our people are very much tied to the land. Most are farmers. And a lot of the farming cycles depend on cues from nature. So usually when a certain bird comes in, that signals that it's time to start planting. Those patterns have been changed now. So they've had to adapt to the changes. And then you have more extreme events now. Before we came here, there were two storms, and it was really lashing the mountains. You know, the winds were very strong. And of course, in mountains, you know, the landslides are problems. And for the first time, there was flooding. Which is weird for a mountain town. It was flooding because of the volume of the water.
But that's why adaptation is very important to us, because the women who are farming, they are developing crop varieties that can withstand droughts or floods. They are doing that because that's how we adapt, and that's how we can be more resilient to these kinds of changes in terms of protection of the soil. They are also innovating. We are also training our own communities to do monitoring themselves.
Maybe we could speak generally about what you see as the major challenges for Indigenous local communities when it comes to climate change.
Well, the major challenges are basically the impacts, you know. Many Indigenous communities are really found in the most fragile ecosystems, whether the Arctic, low-lying islands, or very high mountains. And when there are hurricanes or cyclones or droughts or floods, these are the places that really will be impacted very much. But it's not just direct impacts of climate change, but also some of the solutions that are being provided, wherein they push solutions that are not necessarily respecting rights of Indigenous peoples, like considering hydroelectric dams as renewable energy. It's terrible for Indigenous peoples, because most of these dams were those that sank Indigenous people's territories and forced them to be displaced to other places. So the solutions, we have to also look at them very critically, push that these solutions have references to respecting the rights of Indigenous peoples, and to get their consent, their free, prior, and informed consent if these projects are being brought to their communities. Because that's the only way we can make sure that they are included in the decisions, in making the decisions, and also in making the design of these kinds of solutions that they are bringing into the fold.
One of the challenges is access to resources. There's a lot of money pledged to address forestry, deforestation, and sometimes the solutions are putting pressure on Indigenous lands. So once that Indigenous lands are under pressure, there's this threat of criminalization, displacement, everything. That's one thing that Indigenous peoples have to deal with. That's why we're trying very strongly to assert that the safeguards must be observed. Sometimes the requirements are so difficult and Indigenous peoples are able to access, but then they cannot comply with all of the reporting requirements, the financial requirements, all of those things. So that's a big challenge. All of these monies that have been pledged, mechanisms should be developed so that they can distribute the money equitably and directly to Indigenous peoples.
Can you talk a little bit about the importance of culture and tradition and how that interconnects with this climate change struggle, and how we can maintain and promote one at the same time, you know, not lose what's important?
Indigenous peoples totally rely on their lands and territories and resources, and if those are being destroyed in the name of climate change, that will also mean the end of Indigenous peoples. No, their cultures, they cannot transmit it to the future generations, when a lot of this knowledge is really place-based. We have very sophisticated ideas and concepts of what forests are. It's not just a simple, it's a forest, period. It's not like that. That's where we perform our rituals. That's where we go to respect the spirits of these forests and trees and waters. That's not something that the dominant world knows about and or even appreciate, for that matter. When they say that 80% of forest biodiversity is found in Indigenous territories, that itself is an evidence that we are really doing the right thing, despite the fact that our rights are always violated. So those kinds of evidences are important to come into the picture, because that is what will strengthen the bid of Indigenous peoples to convince the dominant society that these different forms of knowledge, like our traditional knowledge, should really have a place in coming up with the solutions that we are looking for. The more you learn about it, the more you become stronger. And yeah, our places are very beautiful. We have high mountains, we have thick forests, and of course, rivers that are clean up to now. So what else can we ask for? We would like to just maintain it that way.
It was during the opening ceremony of COP26 when I was listening to Sir David Attenborough deliver an impassioned speech that I heard a familiar voice.
We must use this opportunity to create a more equal world. And our motivation should not be fear, but hope.
Can we fix climate problem in one generation? My answer would be yes, we have to.
That's the voice of Kotchakon Vora Akom, a landscape architect from Bangkok and the recipient of the United Nations Global Climate Action Award for her transformative work building innovative landscape solutions for urban resilience in the Thai capital. Some of her projects, I've seen them and reported about them, have captured the imagination of the city and now the world. And I caught up with Koch again in Glasgow to talk about her short moment in the global spotlight.
I just have no idea, actually. And then my friends in the US having these Instagrams, and I just like, what I'm doing there? It's only the leader of each country like to position to be in there. Of course, I feel definitely honored and very surprised. The question is, can we stop the climate crisis or impact by this generation? My answer was be yes, there's no choice. We have to. It's not about our livelihood, but it's actually upcoming generation. And thinking about next generation, if they're about 10 or 12, your son or your daughters, and if in 2030 that we commit, they're only like 20-something. And if 2050 we still fail, they are in their early 40s. At the end of a century, if they're healthy enough, they are in their 90s, which is possible, right? Every leaders, everyone that have opportunity to be here, COP26 or whatever COP it is will be, they should know the reason why they are here for. I'm glad that it's COP, but I feel that it should more impact to those who are really in crisis. There's not enough seat at the table. When you say don't leave anyone behind, but we don't even have a seat. Like let's say women, Southeast Asia, landscape architects, and we got one seat. What about a millions of seats that is missing? Definitely I feel honored, but there's much more to be done. I think my voice is heard, and I just feel that I'm looking for change. It's like so expensive to be here. It's such a slim chance. I don't know, it's like you win the lottery. Not the first prize though, but yes. And I just feel that, oh my gosh, if I didn't get this award, if my work didn't get recognition, and I'm still trying to fight this battle, oh my gosh, it sounds very impossible. I have a seat, a little one, among 1,000 or 10,000 of seat. I hope I can try to make the most out of it at this COP26. I think my work, and it's not just myself, I have like teams who help me. Our work is actually got a voice of the people, the voice of the solution, and that's definitely the voice of hope, the hope from developing world. I don't want to call ourselves as developing with the climate change problem. Everyone is developing. I feel that we are developing world at the moment. With the context that I'm working in Southeast Asia, I hope that my regions can see the possibility, see the hope, or even the next generation in Bangkok, Thailand. They can be more familiar with this kind of solution. Now I'm jumping into many other solutions that need more the resilience design. And right now we can see that we are most vulnerable, and especially Delta City like Bangkok, Jakarta, Penang, and many cities in Vietnam, Manila, yeah, definitely. It's actually so vulnerable that if we don't adapt, I don't think we will exist on the map.
On the day of COP26 that was meant to focus on youth, it's actually outside the venue where the boldest statements have been made. Thousands of people have taken to the streets of Glasgow, most of them young people to send a message to those in power that they want their voices to be heard. Although the crowds here are diverse with different signs and banners and causes, it's quite clear that there is a unified message that young people want to be taken seriously in these negotiations and discussions. The planet is theirs to inherit, and they want leaders here in Glasgow to listen to them.
Young Swede Greta Thunberg has been at the pointy end of a passionate climate movement. Her Fridays for Future school strikes have been ongoing for more than 3 years. And in Glasgow, out on the streets, her voice seems to carry as much weight as anyone else's.
This is no longer a climate conference. This is now a Global North Greenwash Festival. A two-week-long celebration of business as usual and blah, blah, blah.
Also on the stage that day was 24-year-old Filipino John Bonifacio. Simply getting to Glasgow was a monumental challenge, like it has been for so many youth activists. I spoke to him away from the noise of the march.
Hi, I'm John Bonifacio. I'm from Youth Advocates for Climate Action Philippines. I'm also part of the Fridays for Future International Network and the Southern People's Action on COP26. My personal story, when I started with YACAP, it was more of like a, I wouldn't say a side thing, but I was a student at the time. I was taking up medical school and I was doing it when I could. I was just putting a bit of effort into it. But at some point, I stumbled upon a research article that was talking about how almost the entire capital of Manila will be underwater by 2050 due to rising sea levels. And I looked at the map that was on the screen. The hospital and the medical school where I was studying is one of those places that will be underwater. And that really made me think, what am I doing? There's something that needs to be done really when it comes to these issues. And that made me realize that maybe as a person, it made more sense for me to take up activism, climate activism full time instead of, you know, becoming a medical doctor. In some ways, the stars have aligned so that I was able to go here to COP and really engage and really build this, you know, network of climate activists and advocates around the world. And I think that's been a fantastic experience so far in that whole global struggle for climate justice.
So you're one of the handful of activists who have come from Southeast Asia to COP. How do you think you can get your voice heard here and get your agenda heard by the most powerful people who are here negotiating the future of our planet?
It's definitely difficult because even if we're in the same conference area, it still feels like they're miles away. Right now, of course, we're just trying to maximize our opportunity here by going to the places that we can go to, specifically covering issues like adaptation, because that's a very big thing in Southeast Asia and in the Philippines in particular. A lot of the action and a lot of the effort will really go into putting pressure, and that happens outside of COP as well. So organizing a lot of activities and actions, highlighting, of course, what's happening in the Philippines and around Southeast Asia, highlighting the situation of environmental defenders in the region, which is pretty extreme, of course. And yeah, just making sure that our voices are heard. And if they're not going to let us in, we're going to make sure that they can't ignore us as much as we can.
I think Greta has really made youth voices more important. How do you see the value in protest to make yourself heard?
Definitely is an important tool because, again, as you can see, the negotiations, sometimes you don't even let people in. It's just them talking to one another. We must like raise pressure and raise awareness in whatever way we can. And I think physical protests, particularly in a time like now with the pandemic, people gathering together and making sure that, hey, we're here, our voices are here, let's listen to us. Those kinds of things are very important. For a lot of people, it's the most they can do because, again, these world leaders are like not letting us in on the table. So these physical protests, I think, are definitely a vital instrument in ensuring or holding the people in power accountable. And if it comes to the point that, you know, so many people around the world are really clamoring for change, I think it can't really be ignored. If people keep doing what they do and really keeping up the pressure, I think world leaders will think twice about what they're doing.
As a young person, is it exciting to be part of this kind of movement? Or do you feel like it's something that you shouldn't have to be doing?
I feel like we shouldn't have to be here to really beg almost for our basic right to a future. it's really refreshing and really, you know, inspiring as well to be with so many other fellow activists learning from one another. So in that way, you can start seeing that, hey, there is a world beyond, you know, those old white men who are making all the decisions. There are people who are so active and so motivated to, you know, really push for a better planet, a better society. And I think that's what gives me inspiration to keep going. They're really the people I work with and the people I've been able to meet so far.
For you, what would you like them to agree to at the end of all of this COP26?
Ultimately, it boils down to two things I think are, I guess, non-negotiable, hopefully. So first and foremost is that we like rapid emissions cuts from the global north, particularly in line with the 1.5 degrees Celsius pathway. That's something that needs to be done. We have to recognize that the global north can't just do the bare minimum. They have to also realize that countries like the global south, particularly the Philippines, should not be expected to meet the same emissions reductions targets as something as industrialized as the US or countries in Europe. Like, they shouldn't be pressured to do so because that would be completely unfair. Second is finance, reparations and support. It's their debt to the global south. It can be to the tune of $100 billion per year, but that's nowhere near enough. Estimates, I think, put the number closer to $1 trillion. It's something that needs to be at least achieved. It's like a metric to which we can gauge this COP and seeing that something different has been done.
You talked about seeing the map of Metro Manila underwater, and the various other problems that we know are associated with climate change. How do you feel about the future?
I feel like that's something I think about, like, not really every night, but there's sometimes I just wake up and like I'm just frozen thinking about what would it be like, Leon, living in that, you know, those situations or scenarios where 2 degree warmer world, 3 degree warmer world where we're headed. What would that feel like? Because that's something I might experience within my lifetime, right? I wouldn't say that I'm hopeful that things would change, but more of like, I'm demanding that they do. It has to happen. It has to be different. I do not want to live in a world where me and my peers and my generation would have to suffer through this disasters. But when I think about the future, I think of the future as something that I, alongside so many other activists, are actively trying to shape. It's not something that we're just going to passively accept as it comes. It's not something that's going to be handed down to us by these world leaders. It's something we're going to grab from them and like really shape it into something that is for everyone, something that is for people and planet. That's, I guess, where the hope lies. And I think that's the future I want to help build alongside, again, everyone else.
I don't know if these types of global conferences can generate the ideas and answers that the planet needs. But it is clear to me that COP26 is a collision of passion and pragmatism. People are trying to forge a path in any way they can. There are lots of tough issues, but lots of solutions too. Strong convictions, as you've just heard, have power, especially when they're part of a collective voice, and if everyone is willing to listen. This has been Jack Board. Thank you for listening to this special episode of The Climate Conversations. It's back to regular programming and host next week. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Aaron Lowe.